Procopio, Procopio, wherefore art thou Procopio? Deny the canon of veterans and refuse, dear Chevron, or if thou wilt not, apply it at step one, dear court, and reject legislative delegation doctrine. Yeah. So that, my friends, is a great example why Shakespeare never wrote poetry about the law. It just sucks. I'm Chris Adding, and I'm the host of the VA Form 21 podcast. Before we jump into today's topic, I want to apologize for the audio on this session. I usually use a pretty soundproof studio to record these episodes, but they're knocking out a wall to put in a window. I don't know why that's happening, but I am recording in a different location for the next couple of episodes. So today we are going to talk about, well, a lot. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is sitting en banc. This is rare enough as it is, but the issues in this case are of national moment, not only in the general catalog of federal jurisprudence, but also within veterans law. On the table in the case before the court, a case called Procopio, are three major issues: the rule of the pro-veteran canon, the Chevron interpretive framework for interpreting statutes, the presumption of Agent Orange exposure for Navy vets, and the potential overturning of a precedent that has long been the bane of every veteran and every veteran's advocate, Haas v. Peek. But let's get a little business out of the way before we jump into that lengthy discussion. The VA Form 21 podcast is a production of the law firm of Adding Steele. Adding Steele provides caring, effective, and efficient representation to veterans battling the VA for benefits before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. You can learn more about me and about the law firm of Adding Steele at our website, addigsteele.com. That's spelled ATTIGSTEEL.com. The VA Form 21 podcast is going to provide several different types of episodes for you. In some episodes, I'm going to share oral arguments from a particular case at the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims or the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. I'll share my synopsis of the case and prepare you for the arguments you are about to hear. In other episodes, I'll share with you some practical advocacy skills, how to become a better advocate for your veteran clients. And in some episodes, I will talk about the business of veterans law. If your law firm business is not profitable, you cannot continue to help veterans and survivors. Now, I've learned some very hard lessons about how to make a small or solo law firm profitable in the veterans law practice area, and I'd like to share what I've learned with you so that you do not make the same mistakes that I did. If you have suggestions about topics that you would like to hear on this podcast, please feel free to shoot me an email at vetlaw@addigsteele.com. If you are getting value from this podcast, or if you just want to support its continued availability, please click the links in the show notes and become a sponsor of the VA Form 21 podcast over at patreon.com/VAForm21. And I'll put that link in the show notes. As a rookie sponsor over at Patreon, I'll start sending you copies of forms and templates that I use every day in my veterans law practice. And I'll give you some access to every video blog entry or Monday morning coffee talk that I do on Facebook. Becoming a sponsor is completely optional. I'll still love you, and I'll still share all this wonderful information if you don't become a sponsor. But becoming a sponsor, it just makes you feel good about yourself. So why not do it, right? All right, on to the discussion. After I give you the lay of the land, an overview of the legal issues in the fight in the Procopio case, and the procedural posture of that appeal, you can keep on listening to the oral arguments in the Procopio case before a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Trust me, the arguments are worth listening to. Arguing for the appellant is retired U.S. Navy Commander John Wells, and for the government is Eric Bruskin. The argument is a powerful insight into how judges shape and steer oral arguments and how they use questioning of the advocates to make arguments to another judge with a different perspective. So, let's jump into the Procopio case. Cast your mind back all the way to December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. That day was the day Pearl Harbor was attacked and American entry into World War II became a guarantee. Now, December 7th, 2018, we have another day that may live in infamy, although many veterans and many veterans advocates are completely unaware of what's going on. On that day, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit will sit en banc and hear oral arguments in a case styled Procopio v. Wilkie, P-R-O-C-O-P-I-O. Until this summer, the Procopio case was a little-known appeal, another appeal arguing a somewhat unique take on the theory that the presumption of Agent Orange exposure in 38 U.S.C. 1116 should be extended to all veterans who served in support of the Vietnam War, but in particular, Blue Water Navy vets. Before we get into this appeal, though, let's get everybody up to speed on a few topics. These are the legal issues that are at play and that have converged in this perfect storm of a case. First, we're going to talk about the difference between Blue and Brown Water Navy veterans as it pertains to Agent Orange exposure theories. Second, we're going to discuss the Federal Circuit's 2008 decision in Haas v. Peak. Third, we'll discuss the concept of Chevron deference or statutory interpretation using the Chevron framework. Fourth, we'll talk about the pro-veteran canon. And with that foundation, we can finally discuss the significance of Procopio v. Wilkie. However this appeal turns out, it will represent a shift in the balance of power in veterans' law. In what may or may not be rhetorical hyperbole, I believe that the Procopio appeal will be the most significant decision that the Federal Circuit has yet issued in the body of veterans' law. So let's turn now to talk about Blue and Brown Water Navy claims. And to do that, we have to understand Agent Orange, also known as dioxin, the smartest chemical in the world. So we all understand how extensively Agent Orange was used in the 1960s and 1970s. And we also understand that the government has consistently lied to us about how widespread their use of Agent Orange was during the Vietnam War. The government denied it was used in Thailand, then they admitted it. They denied it was used in Korea, until they admitted it. They denied it affected reservists flying the old Ranch Hand C-123s, until they admitted it. Now, currently, they are denying using it in and around military bases near Subic Bay, Okinawa, the Johnson Atoll, and so much more. Until the government changes their minds and admits the extensive use storage of Agent Orange in more places than just Vietnam and Thailand and Korea, we are going to have to continue these fights. What nobody really knows about Agent Orange, though, is how, well, smart it is. When you spray dioxin into the air, or the poisonous plume falls onto the ground and reaches the shore of the Republic of Vietnam, it is stopped dead in its tracks by water. Other chemicals settle onto the earth, they seep into the groundwater, they pollute inland rivers and streams and carry their toxic impact into freshwater bays and ultimately into the ocean. Not Agent Orange. It knows its limits. That's why if you put your pinky toe on the landmass of the Republic of Vietnam for a hair shorter than a nanosecond, Agent Orange got you. But if you took a patrol boat inland on a river in the Republic of Vietnam, it also got you. Until you jumped off a Navy ship in Cameron Bay, swam almost to the shores of the Republic of Vietnam, stopping just inches short of the beach. At that point, Agent Orange was powerless over you. I lay that sarcasm on pretty thick for a reason. We know that dioxin, the chemical compounds that comprise Agent Orange, soaked into the water table in the Republic of Vietnam, seeped into the rivers that led to the bay, that led to the ocean. We know that Navy ships take on fresh and seawater that had to have contained dioxin and then distill that water for drinking on the ships. And we know that Congress also extended a presumption of exposure to Agent Orange to all veterans, quote, who, during active military, naval, or air service, served in the Republic of Vietnam during the period beginning January 9, 1962, and ending on May 7, 1975. That's 38 U.S.C. 1116A1, by the way. Because of that knowledge, if you are a Navy veteran of the Vietnam War era who served on a ship or a boat that operated in one of the inland waterways of the Republic of Vietnam, the so-called brown water, you are known as a brown water Navy vet, and you are entitled to take advantage of the presumption of Agent Orange exposure extended to you by Congress. However, despite all of our scientific understanding and knowledge about how chemical compounds interact with land, sea, and air, if you're a Navy veteran of the Vietnam War era who served on a ship or a boat that did not proceed into the inland waterways of the Republic of Vietnam, you are known as a Blue Water Navy veteran, and the courts have denied the presumption of Agent Orange exposure extended to you by Congress. Why the different treatment? It all comes back to a case called Haas v. Peak, which is 525 Fed 3rd 1168, Federal Circuit case from 2008. As noted above, it's long been considered settled law that the congressional presumption of exposure to Agent Orange extends only to Vietnam veterans who put boots on the ground in the landmass of Vietnam, served in the Brown Water Navy, or served in other places where the VA has decided to concede Agent Orange was used, for example, the Korean DMZ and certain rural Thai Air Force bases. It hasn't always been that way. Now, I'm not going to go deep into the history of Haas, or the regulation at the core of the dispute at Haas, or the M21 manual provision. Instead, I want to pick up the story in 2002 when the VA secretary issued an M21 manual provision that found that the definition of the phrase, quote, service in the Republic of Vietnam, close quote, in 38 CFR 3.307A6 Roman numeral 3 was limited to service in the waters offshore and service in other locations if the conditions of service involved duty or visitation in the Republic of Vietnam. This is the boots on the ground interpretation. And 4 years later, in 2006, veterans won a decisive victory when the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims held in Haas v. Nicholson that the presumption of exposure to Agent Orange extended to Blue Water Navy vets, 20 Vet App 257. That's a 2006 case. The Veterans Court found that even though Congress's phrasing of the scope of the statutory presumption was ambiguous, the M21 provision limiting the presumption to veterans who put boots on the ground in the Republic of Vietnam was too restrictive an interpretation and afforded it no deference. That victory was very short-lived, though. In 2008, after the VA appealed the Veterans Court's opinion to the Federal Circuit, the higher court reversed the Veterans Court in a panel decision in Haas v. Peak. The Federal Circuit agreed that Congress's choice of words in the Republic of Vietnam was ambiguous. In other words, Congress did not clearly resolve the question of whether all veterans, including those in the Blue or Brown Water Navy, would benefit from the presumption of exposure to Agent Orange. Based on that ambiguity, the Federal Circuit then applied a statutory interpretation tool, the dreaded Chevron framework, to find that, in light of congressional ambiguity, the VA's reasonable interpretation of the term in the Republic of Vietnam was entitled to deference. Since 2008, then, Haas has been controlling law, and Blue Water Navy veterans are denied the benefit of the presumption of exposure to Agent Orange and can only use that presumption if they show that, at a minimum, they at least put the very tippy-tippy toenail part of their pinky toe onto dry Vietnamese soil. The fulcrum on which Haas rests is a Supreme Court case from the 1980s, which gave federal courts a standardized tool to interpret statutory language. Or, at least, that's what the Supreme Court thought at the time. And this is the Chevron question. And the ultimate question is whether or not the court should defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute. Let's talk a little bit more about Chevron, though, because it's critical to understand how Haas and Procopio are part of a much bigger battle over the separation of powers. For those who have spent considerable time studying Chevron and statutory interpretation, I apologize. I'm going to paint with very broad brushes and provide only a superficial explanation of Chevron and some of the concepts of statutory interpretation. That said, whenever we put pen to paper, as writers, we create ambiguities. Unless our writing is crystal clear, which is really truly rare, there will often be at least two different ways of interpreting any given written sentence or written paragraph. This natural law of writing, apparently, and somewhat sarcastically said, does not extend to Congress. Congress is presumed to have said what they meant in a statute and meant what they said. However, when a clear writing of Congress does not clearly apply to a given fact situation, it is said that Congress's words are ambiguous. And at that point, it falls on the federal courts, whose job it is to interpret the law that Congress makes. It's their job to interpret those ambiguities and explain what Congress meant or intended. A first battle of the role of the courts in statutory interpretation begins here. There are some who say that courts are limited to explaining only what Congress said in its actual written words. Others argue that courts must interpret or divine congressional intent from those words. And there's variations on those themes, but those are two of the major disputes involving interpretation of congressional statutes. In the 1980s, the Supreme Court gave federal courts a tool that they hoped would bring uniformity and consistency to the question of how to interpret federal statutes. The case in which this tool first appears is Chevron, and you can get the full site in the show notes. Chevron created a two-step analysis. The first step requires that the court decide whether Congress has directly spoken to a precise factual application in statutory language. The court makes this determination using traditional tools of statutory interpretation. If a canon of statutory interpretation solves the interpretive puzzle or resolves the ambiguity, the Chevron analysis ends. If you're at all interested in understanding the breadth and reach of the many canons of statutory interpretation, and there are literally hundreds, I recommend a book authored by the late Justice Scalia and the very much still alive Brian Garner. It's called Reading the Law, the Interpretation of Legal Texts. And you can find a link to that in the show notes. However, if an ambiguity remains after application of traditional canons of statutory interpretation as Chevron Step 1, the court moves to Chevron Step 2. This step is probably better described as the, quote, government wins, close quote, step. Federal courts will often defer to a federal agency's regulatory interpretation of an ambiguous statute if that agency's interpretation, typically through a federal regulation, is based on a permissible construction of the statute. And if a case gets to Chevron Step 2, there is a 99.5% certainty that the government will win. Ultimately, Chevron created a vehicle through which the judicial branch defers to the executive branch's reasonable interpretation of a statutory ambiguity or a perceived statutory ambiguity created by the legislative branch. A problem for many with the Chevron interpretive approach is that it comes dangerously close or even crosses into judicial acquiescence to the delegation of legislative power to the executive branch. And this is where the pro-veteran canon comes into play. Is the pro-veteran canon a howitzer or a pop gun? Let's rewind to the earliest days of the U.S. The battle over the adoption of the Constitution as we know it today is largely over, and a newly born Supreme Court is issuing its first decisions. Among those decisions is one involving a case of Revolutionary War pensioners. Congress had passed a statute that required disabled veterans to apply to the federal courts for their pensions. Federal courts, who wanted only the role that the Constitution gave them, that is, interpreting the law, resisted granting those pensions. The U.S. Attorney General went to the federal courts on a petition for writ of mandamus, asking the Supreme Court to order the lower federal courts to do what Congress required in the statute. The Supreme Court punted on the constitutional issue, an issue which would gain notoriety in the landmark decision of McCulloch v. Maryland almost a quarter of a century later. What Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jay said about why the judiciary was punting in what is known as Hayburn's case was, many people believe, the birth of the pro-veteran canon. I'm going to read to you Chief Justice John Jay's words. The objects of these statutes are exceedingly benevolent and do real honor to the humanity and justice of Congress. The judges desire to manifest on all proper occasions and in every proper manner their high respect for the national legislature. The citation to Hayburn's case is in the show notes, but it's 2 U.S. 409, just to give you an idea of how early in the Supreme Court body of work this decision came. In other words, what Chief Justice Jay was saying was that when Congress passes laws involving veterans, and this is an interpretation that can be disputed and is arguable, so I understand that, but when Congress passes laws involving veterans, federal courts pay a particular respect to that role by manifesting a high respect for the legislative intent or purpose behind those statutes. Fast forward 151 years to a case that involves the application of the Soldier and Sailor Civil Relief Act. Military service members sought, at least in the eyes of the court, to take improper advantage of that act to prevent litigation against him on the grounds that he was a service member at the time of the suit. There were issues with whether or not he was legitimately able to take advantage of that act, and that's why this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. In making its decision, the Supreme Court wrote, "The Soldier and Sailors Civil Relief Act is always to be liberally construed to protect those who have been obliged to drop their own affairs to take up the burdens of the nation. The discretion that is vested in trial courts to that end is not to be withheld on nice calculations as to whether prejudice may result from absence or absence result from the service. Absence when one's rights or liabilities are being adjudged is usually prima facie prejudicial. But in some few cases, absence may be a policy instead of the result of military service, and discretion is vested in the courts to see that the immunities of the act are not put to such unworthy use. That's Boone v. Leitner, and it's a 1943 case. Since Boone, there has been an explosion of dicta and holdings that purport to elucidate the role of this so-called pro-veteran canon, that statutes for veterans are to be liberally construed to favor them. Congress has made clear that the VA is not an ordinary agency, and that's Shinseki v. Sanders. All the sites for these cases that I'm about to rattle off to you are in the show notes. Congress, in addition to making clear that it's not an ordinary agency, the VA was directed to administer a benefit system that's unique in American jurisprudence, a system in which Congress presses hard its thumb on the scales of justice. That's what the court said in Henderson v. Shinseki in 2011. Indeed, Congress only gave the VA enough power to prescribe rules and regulations, and I'm quoting from 38 U.S.C. 501, laws and regulations which are necessary or appropriate to carry out the laws administered by the department and are consistent with those laws. Congress has, however, in very unique and dramatic ways, authorized VA to give life to statutes affecting veterans, and that's discussed in, and I'm going to mispronounce this case, Jacquet. It's a 2002 Federal Circuit case, and the sites are in the show notes, and you can read a little bit of that case. I encourage you to do that. But understanding the scope of the unique variety of authority that's conferred on the VA by Congress requires that a federal court first take note of the pro-veteran nature, scope, and purpose of a statute before deciding whether Chevron is needed to find or resolve any ambiguity in it. That is not a direct holding, but dicta and interpretation of the court's words in Brown v. Gardner in 1994. The Supreme Court said in 1961 that the solicitude of Congress for veterans is of long standing. And in 1998, the Federal Circuit wrote that the beneficence of a grateful nation suffuses the laws Congress writes. I'm paraphrasing the words of the judge in concurrence in that case, and you can read more about that in the show notes. Indeed, in a case that involved a question of whether a veteran must prove VA fault in a service connection by medical malpractice claim, also known as an 1151 claim, the Supreme Court found that if any ambiguity existed in Section 1151, the interpretation of that ambiguity must first survive the application of the pro-veteran canon. That's essentially the issue in Brown v. Gardner. And they cite to a case known as St. Vincent's Hospital, a 1991 case, which also in footnote 9 talks a little bit about the pro-veteran canon. And then in a case involving the interpretation of the jurisdictional statute of the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, 38 U.S.C. 7266, the Supreme Court noted very recently that it had long applied the canon that provisions for benefits to members of the armed services are to be construed in the beneficiary's favor, and then went on to interpret that statute, quote, in the light of this canon, close quote. And that's Henderson v. Shinseki, and that is a case from, I believe that was 2011. I don't have my date in my notes right here in front of me. No court has ever found that the VA has the authority to legislate for veterans. And to many, the pro-veteran canon is a judicial recognition of, indeed judicial deference to, not just congressional solidarity with veterans, but a reservation, an exclusive reservation of the right to legislate to the legislative branch. These four major issues, the plight of the Blue Water Navy veterans, the 2008 presidential decision in Haas, the future of Chevron as a viable interpretive tool, and the role of the pro-veteran canon in statutory interpretation have all converged in a case known as Procopio v. Wilkie. Mr. Procopio's appeal started as just another challenge to Haas v. Peake, coupled with an attempt to directly connect Mr. Procopio's disabilities to his direct exposure to Agent Orange while drinking the shipboard water on a U.S. Navy vessel in the territorial waters of the Republic of Vietnam. He introduced evidence at the BVA showing what I will call the technical, nautical, and scientific evidence showing how dioxin came to be in the brown and blue water around Vietnam, and ultimately, he tried to use this evidence as circumstantial evidence that he was directly exposed to Agent Orange by drinking the water on a U.S. Navy ship in the territorial waters of Vietnam. But he also used this evidence to argue that the Haas decision from 2008 should be limited to its facts because it did not consider all of this technical, nautical, and scientific evidence in relationship to the pro-veteran canon of construction and finding that the presumption of Agent Orange exposure did not extend to Blue Water Navy vets. The Veterans Court rejected both of those arguments, and Mr. Procopio appealed to the Federal Circuit. And that's when things really got interesting. As you will hear in the oral arguments before the Federal Circuit panel after this introduction, Mr. Procopio focused his argument before the circuit panel on how the technical, nautical, and scientific evidence showing that dioxin was in the shipboard drinking water rendered unreasonable the Secretary's interpretation of Section 1116 in its regulation and or its MIM 21 manuals. Throughout the first section of the oral arguments, you will hear the court work to shift that focus and hold that focus to where in the Chevron framework the pro-veteran canon applies. Judge Moore's questioning, in particular, seems to focus on the applicability of the canon at step one, while Judges Wallach and Chen seemed, as near as I can tell, somewhat suspicious of that conclusion. Of course, who knows from the questions? These judges are particularly savvy and extremely smart, and so it's hard to tell sometimes if their questions are revealing their thoughts about the case or whether they're using those questions to elicit arguments, elicit a position, persuade another member on the panel, or for some other purpose. When the Secretary's attorney argued, he appeared to steer his argument to a need for supplemental briefing on the applicability of the pro-veteran canon within the Chevron framework. While I do not agree with the government's arguments or position, the deftness with which Mr. Bruskin fielded and steered the court's questioning was noticeable, and in my opinion, it's a great example of solid oral advocacy. The court sought supplemental briefing after oral arguments asking exactly that question. Where does the pro-veteran canon fit in the Chevron statutory interpretation framework? In response to that supplemental briefing order, Mr. Procopio argued that the pro-veteran canon applied at step one and should be used to determine whether there was an ambiguity in the first place. The government argued that it should be considered, this pro-veteran canon should be considered at or after step two in determining the reasonableness of the government's interpretation of an ambiguous veterans benefit statute. And the National Organization for Veterans Advocates, NOVA, submitted an amicus brief arguing essentially that the pro-veteran canon was a tool that was used not to interpret a statute per se, but to ensure that the judiciary respected congressional primacy in excluding large classes of veterans from certain benefits. After the supplemental briefing, the court issued an order indicating that it had decided to sit en banc. Now, the appeal, as of the recording of this episode, has been fully briefed, including six amicus briefs for 11 veterans advocacy organizations. The Big Six VSOs, law school clinics, NOVA, NVLSP, MOA, the Military Officers Association, Carpenter Chartered, which, by the way, is the law firm for one of the most prolific veterans advocates, Attorney Ken Carpenter. Oral arguments in Procopio are set for December 7, 2008, and I will be there to report back to you on how those arguments go. Essentially, the court is going to consider who wins the tug of war between the pro-veterans canon and the Chevron statutory interpretation framework. So how does all this affect you, the attorney or VSO or advocate representing veterans? I'm going to give you four ways. Number one, most important, if you have a client who is a Blue Water Navy veteran, and I think this reasonably includes gray type veterans, which means those veterans who were arguing that they were exposed in the so-called open water ports to Agent Orange, and your client is being denied benefits because the Agent Orange exposure presumption does not currently extend to certain Navy veterans, consider finding a way to delay adjudication of your appeal until after Procopio is decided. For example, my law firm, Attic Steel, has stayed all of its cases at the Veterans Court and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit if they involve the issue of Agent Orange exposure for a blue water or open water port Navy veteran. If Procopio overturns Haas, and I'm not saying it will, I'm also not saying it won't, if Procopio does overturn Haas and extends the presumption of Agent Orange exposure to Blue Water Navy veterans, they could finally see benefits a lot quicker than those direct exposure arguments that you're making in those appeals. Number two, talk to veterans about this case. Include it in your law firm's email and paper newsletters. Write about it on your blogs. Get it out there on social media. Talk about it in presentations to groups. Tell Blue Water Navy veterans about the Procopio case. Send them to this podcast so they can learn all about it, and suggest that they keep their claims open and pending at least until the Federal Circuit decides Procopio. Most veterans have no idea about Procopio. It has not been communicated out to the veterans population that this case is out there and that it will have such a dramatic, or could have such a dramatic, impact on the veterans community. Help spread that word. Number three, I want you to listen to the oral arguments in Procopio. First, listen to the panel arguments after this introduction is over. And then when this court, the Federal Circuit Court, posts its en banc argument recordings in early December, I will have a follow-up episode or a blog post that discusses those arguments and goes into depth on the various positions of the amici. Number four, regardless how this case turns out, I want you to start thinking about the pro-veteran canon. How can it apply to statutory interpretations in your appeals, whatever they are? Can it allow the Veterans Court or the Federal Circuit to revisit a prior statutory interpretation that did not consider the pro-veteran canon? Can it affect how the Veterans Court or the Federal Circuit interprets the Appeals Modernization Act or the regulations enacted to execute that act? Remember, the pro-veteran canon is not just a tool to interpret statutes. It is a tool that can assist in the interpretation of regulations, too. In closing, I'm reminding myself of an incident back in my childhood. You know, kids being kids, we got our hands on some fireworks. One particular box of fireworks promised to be an amazing display of noise, light, and power. So we snuck by in the tree line out behind a cornfield out back of my house. We lit the fuse on this particular firework and nothing. The darn thing fizzled out, stayed on the ground. Procopio could very well reshape the entire practice of veterans law by giving new control to veterans through a more defined role for the pro-veteran canon. It could overrule Haas and extend the Agent Orange presumption to Blue Water Navy veterans. It could result in a decision that allows the viability of Chevron as an interpretive methodology to be challenged directly before the Supreme Court, which, with two new very anti-Chevron justices sitting on the court, raises some interesting thoughts. In the alternative, this case could be like those fireworks. It could fizzle, and nothing could happen. The law moves very slow. Even when dramatic changes happen in the law, seemingly overnight, they are often the culmination of years and decades spent developing the case law that forms the foundation for a momentous ground shift in the law. Until the last appeal has been decided, it's impossible to know if Procopio is the culmination of years of work or the cornerstone of a new foundation in the law. With that, I'm going to turn you over to the oral arguments. And while you're getting ready to adjust your volume, sometimes there's a change in the quality of audio between my recording and the court's recording of oral arguments. While you're lowering your volume a little bit just to be ready for that, you can find all the links to all the briefs at the Veterans Court, at the Federal Circuit, before the panel, before the supplement, or in response to the supplemental briefing order, and the en banc briefs, and all of the amici briefs are on the website at addictsteel.com. Just look for episode 11 of the podcast and you will get all the links. I encourage you to go read as many of them as you can. As you're listening to these arguments, you're going to hear three judges. You're going to hear Judge Moore, that's the female voice, and then Judge Wallach and Judge Chen. You're also going to hear two advocates. You're going to hear Commander, U.S. Navy retired Commander John Wells arguing for Mr. Procopio, and you're going to hear government's attorney Eric Bruskin arguing for the VA. So, without any further ado, adjust your volume and get ready to hear some amazing oral arguments in Procopio v. Wilkie.
2017-1821, Procopio versus Wilkie. Mr. Wells, please proceed.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Commander John Wells, U.S. Navy retired. I represent the veteran Procopio. Every time we have a blue water case, the question of Haas comes up, and I think it's important to see exactly what Haas was addressing. That bold line here about 100 miles off the mainland of Vietnam was the area that was sought to be restored in Haas. Notably, the original general counsel's opinion, which kind of started this mess, said that in order to be considered or presumed to be exposed, had to serve within the boundaries of the Republic of Vietnam.
Is this an exhibit in this case?
Yes, it's Appendix 94, but it's not very clear. That's why we put this in.
That's an understatement.
Sorry, we took the actual record, and as we reproduced it, it just went away. You can see the two lines.
So is the red line the 12-mile line, or what we would call the territory, including the territorial seas?
Actually, no, Your Honor. The red line is what they call the baseline. Intersects the outermost islands of Vietnam. The dash line, 12 miles out from that, I personally checked the plotting, by the way, is the territorial seas. But under the old Vietnam Service Medal line, which the VA recognized as a presumption, a ship up here in the Gulf of Tonkin, where there was no spraying, we never sprayed off the north, would have been presumed to have been exposed.
Okay, but why don't we talk about why Haas versus Peak doesn't preclude us from getting to your argument in this case?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we do feel that Haas versus Peak was wrongly decided, and based on a couple of things. First off,
when you say wrongly decided as a panel, we can't necessarily challenge that unless you're telling me there was an issue they didn't consider, in which case it's not binding on this court.
There are several issues they did not consider, and quite frankly, they did not have the evidence that was developed since and brought to the court. And I would invite the court's comment, or the court's review of starting at about 53 in the appendix and going through really to about, 129 in the appendix. We've been able to develop hydrologist statements, for example, which show that the Agent Orange did actually infiltrate into the South China Sea.
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with whether or not the words served in Vietnam ought to be interpreted as including the territorial seas or whether it ought to be foot on land only.
Well, as not brought up before Haas, but it has been brought up subsequently in the case below, the United States has actually recognized the territorial seas as part of the sovereign territory of the nation. They did that in the 1954 Geneva Accords, which we cited in the briefs.
So part of that is your argument that when Congress passed this legislation saying served in Vietnam, it understood Vietnam to include the territorial seas by virtue of international law and recognition thereof.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, Congress is presumed to know the law. Maybe that's not always the best assumption, but in this case, I think they did.
Is there any legislative history that indicates that when Congress wrote service in the Republic of Vietnam, it was contemplating the law of the sea?
Not specifically into the committee reports. We have talked with some of the people that were in Congress, Senator Grassley, for example, and who introduced a resolution that's still pending that says that was the intent to include the territorial seas. And, Your Honor, I think...
What is the status of the bill about amending the statute to specifically include bays, harbors, territorial waters?
I'm glad you asked that question because I was going to have to disclose that. Currently, the bill is pending before the House Veterans Affairs Committee with 329 co-sponsors. We held a legislative hearing on it in April 2017. It was brought up for a markup, which is final passage in November the 2nd. Unfortunately, there's a problem with what they call the pay for or the offset under the Pay-as-you-go Act. There was a political issue, and it was tabled. It's being brought up again this coming Tuesday, okay? And in fact, I just saw this morning the revised bill, which actually includes a different method of paying for the bill. I can't guarantee you that it's going to be passed out of committee on Tuesday. The indications are that we believe it will be.
Okay, but why don't we get back to this case? Is it your view that Haas doesn't bind us because the Haas panel expressly said that the veteran waived and did not raise the pro-veteran canon, namely the statutory canon that says statutes ought to be construed when possible in light of the remedial nature of the veteran statute. And so that issue is not off the table, and that it opens the door, since the court said it expressly did not decide that in the first case, that we can therefore revisit that statutory interpretation here?
That is exactly correct, Your Honor. I think we mentioned that in the briefs. We also had to look at your previous decision in Sears in 2003 seemed to limit that, but that was before Henderson, and Henderson has reaffirmed the pro-veteran canon of statutory construction.
Let me be clear about something. Sears says that you can't use the pro-veteran canon to sort of trump at step two the agency's gap-filling authority. But what Sears doesn't say is that you can't apply the pro-veteran canon at step one and therefore determine the statute is not, in fact, ambiguous.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That was the second point I was going to make. And the other point I wanted to make is in Sears, it was basically, let's take the pro-veteran canon, and that was the only thing going for the veteran. Here we have a wide body of hydrological evidence, military evidence, and even the Institute of Medicine, which shows
it's interesting that the carrier was within, and the log shows within the 12-mile limit.
Yes, sir. What would happen is these carriers would turn into the wind. The wind was offsetting from Vietnam, so they would go in to launch and recover aircraft, or sometimes if an aircraft was shot up, they would go in to pick it up. But you're right. This is an excellent case in that respect because the log actually says that they entered the territorial seas.
Is there anything that shows when the distillers were running? Did they just go 24/7?
Your Honor, the 24/7. I was chief engineer on a number of those ships, and the same distillation plants were used to make water for the boilers and potable drinking water. Okay. So. And especially off of Vietnam, you're in more of a tropical climate where you've got a very high sea injection temperature. Without trying to get too technical, that reduces your efficiency and makes water a problem. As an engineer on these ships, sometimes in the middle of the night, I was having to get hourly reports on the water situation. Water was my business, and it was a problem. Your Honors, I think that one of the things we've shown and was not available to Haas was the fact that there has been the infiltration into the South China Sea. If you look at, Appendix 107, it talked about off the Mekong Delta, the Mekong River, how the...
So that brown water that's coming out into the South China Sea
exactly
goes
right.
For a long... It certainly goes through the 10-mile...
Definitely. No question. And, as Mr. Bruskin said in his brief, you have to serve in the estuarine. Well, the estuarine goes way out. And in fact, here
it looks like from the log that the vessel is actually going through past the Mekong Delta.
That's
so
correct.
Within that 10-mile limit, it looks like it's going right through that brown plume.
Yes, Your Honor. And off the Mekong, it will actually go out past the territorial seas, past Vietnam service metal area. The Chen report in there says that, it was either Chen or Woloski's, I get the two mixed up, that it'll go out several hundred kilometers in about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So, it's just no question. And that's...
I guess, just so I can keep things straight in my head, all of this data and test studies that you're explaining about brown water going into the blue water, that goes to the question of whether the VA's choice of interpreting the statute the way it did, foot on land, is reasonable or unreasonable. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
As opposed to the question of whether the statute itself, when it says service in the Republic of Vietnam, is inherently unambiguous, inherently clear, and necessarily includes territorial waters. I think there's two separate questions here.
I think you're exactly right, Your Honor, and in the answer, both of them favor the veteran. Service in the Republic of Vietnam when you factor in the recognition of the United States, would include the territorial seas. You know, even in Haas went off on kind of a tangent in the Zhang decision, but even in the underlying Code of Federal Regulations article in Zhang said territorial seas are part of the sovereign territory.
How should we read what I'll just call Haas Part 2, which is the panel opinion's denial of the request for rehearing, where it explained that in Haas, the appellant did not raise the pro-veteran claimant canon in the original appeal, and it raised it on request for rehearing, which was, in the panel's view, waived. But nevertheless, the panel went on and addressed the pro-veteran claimant canon and explained, I think it explained, why it didn't feel like it would, if applied, create a different result.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So
but
could you explain how we should think about that? I mean, on one level, it didn't address it in the first opinion, but it did address it in the second opinion and concluded that it wasn't going to, in this particular case, help the veteran.
Yes, Your Honor, but you remember that was based somewhat on the Sears opinion, and it was before the Henderson opinion, which came out in 2011. And I think you have to read what Haas said in light of Henderson, and in applying Henderson, I believe had Henderson been decided before Haas, I think the Haas court would probably have come to a different result.
So is it your view that Sears is not good law in light of the Supreme Court's Henderson opinion?
The issue with Sears was there was the only thing they had going for it was the pro-veteran claimant. Okay, here in Procopio, we have a body of evidence in addition to the pro-veteran claimant. And, Your Honors, I am into my rebuttal time.
Yes, let me save it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Mr. Breskin.
Good morning. May it please the Court.
Mr. Breskin, if a U.S. naval vessel sails within 12 miles of the shoreline of the Republic of Vietnam, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, is it the position of the United States that that vessel is subject to the legal jurisdiction of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam?
I don't know an exact answer, Your Honor. I think the question stems, though, from combining both defining the reach of the sovereignty of a nation with defining what the terms of the Agent Orange Act meant. When Congress passed the Agent Orange Act, they were not seeking...
Well, no, you can answer my question whether that ship is in Vietnam or not.
I believe it is considered in Vietnam for purposes of, you know, maritime jurisdiction and other purposes of international law.
Right.
The Haas Court addressed this same argument in determining whether Congress's intent was clear enough. They looked at the legislative history. Mr. Haas suggested that there was a treaty that defined the sovereignty of Vietnam as including its territorial waters, and the court said there's no indication that Congress chose any of these competing methods for defining the phrase Republic of Vietnam in the Agent Orange Act, and therefore it moved on to step two.
But if the Haas court was incorrect, I mean, it may be precedential, that's a different question, but if it was incorrect about step one, it never needed to get to step two.
Well, if it
that
was...
statute is clear, that in Vietnam means within the legal territory of Vietnam, including its offshore.
If this court were to believe that it was clear, I believe it would need to overrule Haas en banc.
Why?
Because Haas determined that that statutory phrase was ambiguous.
Haas determined that the statutory phrase was ambiguous, but it expressly indicated that it did not take into account the pro-veteran canon, and that would be taken into account in the determination of whether it's ambiguous or not. All canons are taken into account in step one, not step two of Chevron.
But step one of Chevron is looking at whether or not Congress's intent is clear from the language of the statute itself. So I'm not sure exactly where the pro-veteran canon would come into say that a language that is otherwise ambiguous becomes unambiguous.
What an interesting argument you could make on behalf of drug smugglers in who are apprehended within 12 miles of the United States shoreline.
Except that if there is an indication in the laws that govern the jurisdiction of the statute, then of the United States, then that would be clearly applicable there. Here, the statute itself was not seeking to define Vietnam's jurisdictional reach or the powers that Vietnam would have over its waters. It was simply seeking to define which veterans can use presumption of exposure to herbicides. And that was based not on the sovereignty of the nation, which is completely unrelated to...
Can you help us think through this pro-veteran claimant canon? I mean, I've seen in the Supreme Court has referred to it as a canon of construction, which suggests that it's some tool for interpreting a statute. And so now it's one more tool of the many tools you use to try to understand the meaning of a statute. And so what is the government's view of how that applies in the context of statutes relating to veterans' benefits? Are you saying that it really doesn't have any role to play?
No, I think it's wrapped up into the Chevron Step 2 review of the agency's interpretation.
But I would assume you would agree that opinions like Sears, Terry, Guerra, etc., all say that the pro-veteran claimant canon cannot override a reasonable and reasonable agency interpretation of ambiguous statute.
Correct. And
so then the pro-veteran claimant canon really has no role if it doesn't have any role in step one, and I guess we've already said it has no role in step two. So what role does it really have?
Well, the way the Haas court en banc in denying the rehearing en banc seemed to view it is something to factor in into determining whether or not how the agency has defined an ambiguous phrase is reasonable. They found that the Haas VA's interpretation of the ambiguous statutory phrase was owed deference and was reasonable and was not overcome by the proclaimant canon because it would not necessarily result in a pro-veteran result in every instance. And they noted that the VA had already interpreted the ambiguous statutory language in a pro-veteran manner.
Does the denial in bank prohibit us from applying a canon to determine the validity in step one?
No, it's not binding on this court in the same way that the Haas panel decision is, but I think it is helpful and instructive that the court recognized it was waived, but then said we're nevertheless going to look at this and determine whether or not it would have had an effect on the way we...
So do you understand the denial of rehearing in Haas, that opinion, to be considering the pro-veteran claimant canon in the context of step two as to whether the VA's choice of interpreting the statute was reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then ultimately it said it was reasonable or it was going to defer to it, and the fact that there was this canon didn't override it, although I guess you're saying that it still gets some consideration in the context of the overall question of reasonableness of the VA's.
I believe that's correct, and I think that's
so,
what the
but now that gets us back to Haas, nor any other case in this kind of context with VA benefit statutes ever expressly talking about this canon in the context of what we can just call step one, in trying to figure out whether the statute is clear, whether congressional intent is clear.
As I stand here, I'm not aware of a case
Where
the proclaimant canon was used to take language that was otherwise viewed as ambiguous and render it unambiguous in favor of the veteran. And I would suggest that use of it doesn't necessarily make sense because the VA is in a position where they're interpreting ambiguous statutory phrases, and they are the experts at doing so, and they're empowered to do so. And so they're looking at what are the consequences of the different interpretations that we can give to statutory language. And so I think it is much better in the first instance to give the VA the opportunity to take that into account when it's considering how to interpret ambiguous statutory phrase than having the court do so in the first instance.
If it's ambiguous. On the other hand, if we look at the language in Vietnam and we say, well, it could be ambiguous or it could be perfectly straightforward, and by the way, we have a canon of statutory construction, which tells us it should be looked at as unambiguous,
we stop right there, don't we?
You can. I mean, in some ways, that is what the Henderson court did. It said, you know, we find the plain meaning of this rule to be X. Oh, and by the way, this is the courts with the proclaimed canon. But they didn't use it as a tool of construction to take something they viewed as ambiguous. So I think to apply the proclaimed canon here, the court would need to disagree with the Haas panel in that the language of Section 1116 was ambiguous.
Well, that's only if we agree with you that the canon is limited to Step 2.
Correct, Your Honor.
If we find the canon is applicable at Step 1, then Haas doesn't bind this court, does it?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Yes, you do. You just don't want to say it.
Well, I mean, I haven't thought through that hypothetical because...
Okay, well, think through it now.
Mr. Procopio,
you've got 6 minutes and 35 seconds. I'd like the government's position on whether or not, if Step 1 must consider pro-veteran canon, if that's where we find it applies and not in Step 2, then did the Haas court decide the statute was ambiguous, and does that bind us under those circumstances?
I suppose the panel decision would not. No, Your Honor. But I do think that the court should take into account that the same panel, in a request for rehearing, noted that it would not have changed the result of their review, both with respect to 1116 or the VA's interpretation.
The only question that Judge Moore posed was binding or not binding. That's a either or, and you've already given your answer.
Perhaps, Your Honor. But I'm moving on to the next step, which is what would the court do with that
if
predicate determination?
Yeah.
And I would suggest that to some extent that issue hasn't been very well developed in the briefing here because Mr. Procopio was not – he was arguing that Haas in general should be limited to its facts because it didn't apply the proclaimed canon. But, you know, the extent to which it fits into Chevron Step 1 or Chevron Step 2 is admittedly something I haven't spent sufficient amount of time investigating to answer the court's question.
Do you think we should ask for additional briefing on that?
I think if the court was thinking about making a determination that Haas does not bind the panel because the proclaimed canon should apply at Step 1 and that would make Haas non-binding, then yes,
but
Your Honor.
But he argued that in his blue brief. Let me show you the places where he did. You had an opportunity to respond to that exact argument. And
Your Honor,
your response was it applies in Step 2.
My response to the question here, what he was saying was that Haas, in general, does not bind this court because Henderson reaffirmed the proclaimed canon that wasn't applied.
No, he said Haas doesn't bind this court because it didn't take into account the proclaimant canon when it made its determination.
Right, but its entire determination, not specifically at Step 1 of the Chevron analysis. And that's the more granular point that I think, you know, if the court were inclined to rule that way, the court might benefit from some additional briefing on that question. What he was arguing is that Henderson, in effect, overrules Sears and means that if there's any ambiguity in a statute, that the agency is per se unreasonable in making an interpretation that can be viewed as not being pro-veteran in every instance.
Can you, I get the feeling we might come back to this, but let me ask a related question, which is my understanding of this canon, the veteran canon, the origins of it is in this notion that this is like a remedial statute and we want to give liberal construction to remedial statutes, which is a doctrine that's used and applied for other statutes that are deemed to be remedial. And I guess I'm wondering, what do you have a view of what that actually means and how it actually operates in statutory construction, this notion that we give liberal constructions to remedial statutes? How does that actually work when we're trying to use that doctrine with all the other traditional tools of statutory construction?
I think if you are looking at whether or not an agency has reasonably interpreted an ambiguous statutory phrase, you have to look at whether the agency's view of it is proclaimant in some manner, not in every instance. I mean, this court has already held in Sears just because it doesn't result in the veteran getting benefits.
You're immediately putting my question in the context of an interpretation that an agency does. And I'm wondering if that's really, you know, necessarily the context. It's really more a question of maybe the courts. Maybe the courts have to figure out what the meaning of a statutory term is.
Well, I think
in that context, what do we do? How do we apply this so-called liberal construction of remedial statutes? There's a few different ways I've thought. One is maybe their statute is not clear, and there are a handful of reasonable options of what this rather unclear statute means. And because of the remedial nature of the statute, we want to give a liberal construction to it. And so therefore, we should select the interpretation that's most beneficial to the largest class of the parties that were intended to be, you know, benefited by the statute. Another way of looking at this doctrine is, well, the statute is not clear, but it's close. Maybe it really is leaning in hard in one direction, and it turns out that direction is benefits the intended beneficiaries. And so therefore, we will put this cherry on top, this liberal construction doctrine, and then confirm that that's in fact what the term, the perhaps unclear but almost clear term means. What is the government's view on how to understand this doctrine?
My view of the two ways you said it are both reasonable, except that the premise of them is that it should be the court initially interpreting what it is Congress meant. If Congress's language was clear, then there wouldn't be a question of what Congress meant when it said these words. It would be clear on its face. Where it's not,
One can determine that a statute is clear using canons of statutory construction. That's basic Sutherland stuff.
You're not suggesting, now let's put it in the context of Chevron. Chevron step one, that the agencies get to control step one.
No, yeah.
That's a court responsibility.
That is a court responsibility, but
so let's move on.
But what I would suggest is that the court making a determination without the VA's input whatsoever on what is pro-veteran is not necessarily the best use of that tool, which is why I think the Haas court used it to look at what the VA had done when it interpreted the statutory language. Because what may appear to be the pro-veteran on just a reading of a congressional phrase may not necessarily be so. And it's clear that where there's an ambiguity, it is the agency has the power to fill gaps and interpret that. And so, you know, I would suggest that although it is clear that tools of statutory construction can be used at Chevron step one to try and determine clear intent, the VA benefit, you know, structure and statute are meant to be interpreted by, where they're vague, meant to be interpreted by the VA and then reviewed by this court. Congress has been clear when it wants courts to, in the first instance, determine the best way to interpret a phrase. In the United States v. California case that Mr. Procopio cites regarding the Submerged Lands Act in 1965, the Supreme Court made clear that the statute told the court to determine how to define inland waterways. But without that sort of clear indication that it should be up to the courts to define an otherwise ambiguous phrase, the normal course, which I think makes sense in the veteran system, is for the VA to do so and then for that to be reviewed. Okay. I think I'm over my time.
No, okay. Thank you, Mr. Breskin. It's very helpful. Mr. Wells, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors, and please the court. One of the interesting things that comes out of this whole question of whether it's a step one, the pro-veteran canon, is step one or step two, actually, as you can go back to the Sears case, which talks about its applicability onto the veterans benefits legislation, whether or not it conforms with the spirit of the veterans benefits legislation, and that was Sears at 1332. I think that moves it definitely and completely into the step one arena, because you have to compare it about what the intent was. And what is the intent of the veterans legislation? It's to take care of the veterans. Part of the problem we've had is this was supposed to be a non-adversarial system. It was a system to provide benefits for those who went out there and were hurt in the line of duty. And we've gotten away from that. We've gotten too esoteric. and too legalistic, which is probably why we're here today. Applying that pro-veterans canon in step one, as I think the Supreme Court so desired, and even as Sears admitted, and by the way, that's on page 30 of my brief, if anybody would like to look at it, you know, shows that we definitely have got to provide these folks this benefit and to take a very liberal and reasonable approach. And when you talk about reasonableness, let's talk about that for just a second. I realize that's kind of getting a little into a more advanced step. But the whole basis of Chevron, the whole basis of Sears, the whole basis of the law is that the agency's approach has to be reasonable. Mr. Ruskin talked about VA experts, but one thing he has never brought forth and the VA has never brought forth and is not in the record is any expert information to basically refute what we're saying. We've brought in hydrologists, we've brought in military officers, we've brought in a number of people, and all of the evidence, not the preponderance, not clear and convincing, all of the evidence goes on to the conclusion that these folks were exposed and the Veterans Benefits legislation was set up to take care of people who were exposed. One other thing.
Is it your view that jet fighter pilots that fly over the landmass or the territorial waters would also be serving in the Republic of Vietnam?
No, and I think we may have addressed that because there was B-52 pilots, for example, that would come from Guam, fly over and attack North Vietnam, 30,000 feet and go back. And no, certainly they would not have been exposed and certainly they would not have the problem. Now, if there was a jet pilot
I'm now going back to your statutory interpretation question, which you were advancing that the territorial waters are necessarily part of Vietnam. Why, just thinking about the statute and understanding the statute of what does it mean to be in Vietnam, why wouldn't the airspace above the landmass also be in Vietnam?
Not on North Vietnam, certainly not, but on South Vietnam, there is a strong possibility of that if you apply that to the strict construction of that pro-veterans canon. We won't deny that. Normally, what we've been doing with aviators is a direct exposure theory. If they flew in through the clouds in South Vietnam or landed in South Vietnam.
There's international law that talks about how territorial waters are part of the sovereign, but isn't the airspace also?
The airspace is also part of the sovereignty,
yes. So then, I guess, to follow through on your conception of the statutory term, why wouldn't, just talking out loud here, why wouldn't a service member that was flying through the airspace also be included?
The airspace of the Republic of Vietnam would be, okay, not the Democratic Republic of Vietnam up there, but within the Republic of Vietnam it would. But, you know, one of the other interesting things, and I'm sorry I'm out of time, but if I could just make this one last point with the court's indulgence. We don't really have a problem with the statute. We don't have a problem with the CFR. We don't even really have a problem with general counsel's opinion. They all say within the borders of Vietnam. This interpretation came out in an M21 manual, and as this court has found in Gray most recently, we can't touch the M21 manual on any type of Section 502. We believe that the plain reading of the statute and the Code of Federal Regulations and the General Counsel's opinion, especially when applying these canons, shows that the territorial seas and probably the airspace were within the Republic of Vietnam and should be included. Thank you, Your Honors. I'm sorry I ran over time.
Thank both counsel for their argument. The case is taken under submission.